The following program contains archived content. Some of the information may now be out of date.
This episode of Word for Word may contain language or themes that are not suitable for all listeners. If you're experiencing difficulty, please reach out for support. You can reach QLife, an anonymous and free LGBTI support service, by calling 1-800-184-527 or call Lifeline 24 hours a day on 131114 for crisis support and suicide prevention. In an emergency, please call 000.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, hosted by Lisa Dano Daniel, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Hi, welcome to Word for Word. I'm your host, Lisa Dano Daniel. Today's guest is a testament to the power of recovery and of the very real potential to overcome substance abuse. Having been in the grips of addiction as a high-functioning alcoholic for the best part of 30 years, my guest is now proud of his 13 years in recovery. He's discovered a world ripe with possibilities, from managing a food retail business to running marathons, skydiving, travelling the world, and performing a variety of roles in radio broadcasting. It's a life he didn't expect beyond his wildest dreams. Welcome to Word for Word, David Gale.
Hello, Lisa. It's great to be here.
That's a pretty big introduction.
It's a little
bit different to what I usually do in introductions. Don't usually hang it out there quite so brutally. But we will talk about your addiction at some stage, and we will talk about the fact that you are in radio broadcasting and you have a show here on Joy called Hooked. Want to talk about that too. But let's get to the bottom of how you became adult David. Tell me about your family. Do you have siblings? Are your parents still with us? Where did you grow up?
Strangely enough, I had two parents, a mother and a father, and a sister. All have now passed, unfortunately, but
really?
Some lost alone.
Your whole family at
alone.
Your age?
Yeah.
Because you're not that old.
Oh, 59.
Yeah, but that's not... You know, that is quite young to lose both your parents and a sibling.
Yeah.
Was your sibling younger or older?
My sister was a couple of years older than I am. She passed away last year, alone, unfortunately, and probably not in a great space either. I think, I found her body and at first I thought to myself, this is really one of those images that you'll never lose. And in fact, I think I found her more in peace in death than I found her in life. So, she had a very hard life.
Had you been trying to contact her? Is that why you...
Yeah, it went on for a few days, starting with an outreach from a friend of hers, and they were a little bit concerned that she wasn't responding to phone calls. My sister and I, we didn't have a great relationship, so, I started making calls. She wasn't answering, and I thought, well, she doesn't particularly hold me in the highest esteem. But at the same time, then I started checking on her apartment and finally had to make the call and go and see if everything was okay.
Tell me a little bit about your relationship with your sister. You say that you weren't close.
No.
Was that something that emanated from childhood?
Well, it sort of goes back to childhood in the fact that we were both adopted and our parents were around the 40 age group. So they were considerably older than we were. So that doesn't happen, it's not considered unusual these days, but in those days, people would get married in their early 20s and start having kids straight away. And so there was a generational difference. I was the youngest and, I often joke about the fact that the youngest is usually the favourite. If you ask your mother, am I the favourite? And she says, look, I don't have favourites. You're not it. But, I was sort of spoilt a little bit. My sister became a little bit rebellious during her teenage years, as many young girls do.
So she was older than you?
Yes, 2 years older. Mm-hmm. And, we didn't really share that much in common. Not because we were adopted, but, we were in a very loving family. But we just didn't really have the same ideas.
Tell me about your parents.
Very hardworking. They got married later in life and they bought a house. I was brought up in Blackburn. And, I look back to that generation because they were post-war children or, their lives really started post-war. They worked really hard to provide everything for the family. And in retrospect, when I look back, I sort of go, they worked really hard in order to make sure that there were new shoes for school or that there was money put aside every week for the electricity bill or for a Christmas present or for whatever. And everything that they did was devoted back to that family unit, which I don't know whether that happens now because of our impatience or whether we look at things in a shorter term sort of way and we sort of go, I've got to have that right now. But they were also concerned from their generation about what the neighbours thought as well.
I think it's now sort of progressed to we don't just worry about what the neighbours think. We worry about what the entire world thinks in terms of social media. And true. Because, you know, now it's not just the neighbours that are looking, it's everybody, and we're presenting ourselves in a certain way.
That's also very isolationist as well, if I can put that in.
It is very isolationist.
But, you know, in our 20s we worry about what people think, in our 40s we worry about what people say, and in our 60s we realise they're not actually talking or thinking about us, or we couldn't give a damn.
Can't wait till I'm 60.
Same here. Same here.
Have you ever tried to find your biological parents?
No, I haven't. And it's a strange thought that's been going through my head just recently after the passing of my sister. I'm sort of thinking, well, you know what? I'm not going to upset the apple cart. And if anything, I'd probably do it more so just to be able to say to my biological mother, I don't need a relationship with her, but just to be able to say, you know what? I'm okay and I don't want you to worry. Everything turned out okay. That's probably the only driving force. And I might pursue that. I might not. I don't know.
Did your sister follow up with her?
No, she didn't. But yeah. I think she felt a certain dissatisfaction about that. Maybe she thought she could have done better or whatever. But it's the same in our LGBTI community. People that adopt want children that much. And I transfer that back to the fact that my parents really wanted children that much. They weren't able to have children. In those days, there wasn't the technology that's around these days. They couldn't have had IVF or any of the other technologies that are available. But they wanted children that much. Now, was I snatched from a natural mother? You know, I was born just around the corner from these studios at QV, and it was a place where I assume that my natural mother was probably single and pregnant, and, you know, there was shame and everything else in those days. This is, you know, right in 1960. So what would you do? You know, either you were talked into your child being adopted out, or, you know, if you didn't agree to that, you had this awful life ahead of you, supposedly.
What age were you when you found out that you were adopted?
Quite early on. My parents weren't shy about that. And I would say probably even from as early as four-ish, I would have known that I was adopted. But it was used in a term called you're a special child.
Yeah, I've heard that before from several adopted friends of mine who, you know, that's the way it was couched. And I think that's a great way of putting it, especially in light of what you were just saying about if you couldn't naturally have kids, it was very hard to.
Of course.
And I mean, adoption even in those days would have been quite difficult. And they were, as you say, your parents were a little bit older.
Yeah.
So I imagine it was quite a challenge. There was probably quite a wait list at that stage.
Yeah, there probably was. But they were very fortunate and very lucky to have two children.
What were you like at school?
Pretty good.
You were a good student?
Pretty good, yeah.
Smart?
Yeah, I was pretty smart. I remember, it was funny, I was talking to somebody the other day in grade six. I think we did the first term, and for the rest of the year I helped other kids because I was very bright and very, very absorbing. I loved to learn and I loved numbers and all sorts of things. So, and then right through to HSC, yeah, I pretty well excelled.
What did you want to be when you were at school?
Difficult question. I think later in the years I thought I should become a dentist. I don't know why, but, you know, we have limited exposure to different professions as young people, and we might follow what our parents do, or we might follow the people that we come in contact with. So, and for some reason I thought I should be a dentist. Maybe I thought that there was a lot of money in dentistry. Maybe I thought, you know, there would be that personal contact. I don't know. My marks weren't good enough, but in those days I went on to an office job, which was considered fantastic.
What did your father do as a career?
He was an engineer.
And did your mother have a career at all?
No, my mother was a housewife, but my father was an engineer.
So no sense that you were going to follow down those?
Yeah. No. No, I didn't think so, no.
What age were you when they passed away?
Let's see. My mother would have died a good 20 years ago. So, you know, I would have been in my early 40s. And my father, only about 10 years ago.
Just of illness?
Yeah. Old age, certainly. Yeah. My mother was 79, my father was 87. So
yeah, I guess in those days that was kind of your, you know, the age that you did move on.
Well, in those days, you know, when of growing up, if somebody died in their 50s, it was considered, oh, that was a bit short. If they were 66, they had the grand present of having 1 year worth of retirement. Well, that's great. That's the reward for all of your life. And if they're in their 70s, they thought, oh, that was a good innings. Today, of course, our longevity is so much higher. And I don't know about you, but, you know, even at 59, I feel I've still got so many years left. You know, people say life is short. It's actually really long. As long as we look after the vehicle we're travelling in, it's really long and there is so much to do and so much to enjoy.
I remember chatting to my mother. I was very young. She went grey when she was 30 and she was mortified by it. And I do remember her, you know, sort of turning 40 and that sort of thing and just going into a depression for a few days about how old she was. Now, you know, I'm in my early 50s or mid-50s soon and I just feel like that's kind of like 30.
Yeah. I guess, and the only, you know, regret about youth, I suppose, is that if we were younger and we knew what we knew now, that would be amazing. That's the only thing.
We almost need to do life in reverse. Like, have the experience and the knowledge when we're really young and maybe lose that as we get older or something. Yeah. I mean, it seems that we need it when we're younger. I don't know why it happens the way it does. Let's talk a bit about sexuality and coming out and that sort of thing. What age do you think you were when you started to feel that you were perhaps different to other boys or other people?
Probably in puberty. Certainly as a child, you know, I was enjoying school and doing all that sort of stuff. I wasn't heavily into sports. I probably didn't hang out with as many of the other guys. You know, I always had a bestie as well. There was something a little bit different, I felt, and we all do, I suppose. Well, not everybody, but...
Because I hate using that word different.
Yeah.
But it's the only way to really, like, you know, normal is off the table. But different seems to be the word that comes up time and time again when I speak to people in here.
Well, different is, like, why do I like to play with Barbie as well as cars? And why do I want to play Twister and listen to ABBA records instead of, you know, AC/DC and go playing footy all day?
The other word that comes up a lot is outsider.
Yeah.
You know, some people sort of say, I just felt like an outsider, even though I was part of the sport group or they did everything, but they just always felt like they were a little bit outside.
And we're also talking a different language as well at that stage too because of our interests and whatever. So, you know, through sort of my teens, I certainly realised that there was something different. Number 96 came on TV. It was very exciting. It was the 70s. And strangely enough, my parents would say, look, let's stay up and we'll watch this together. And we watched every single episode. I was identifying with Dudley Butterfield and I can't remember his partner's name.
Was it Arnold?
No. He was anyway, there were portrayed gay characters there. And why was I watching Dudley Butterfield instead of Abigail? Because Abigail had the big tits and I should be watching her, but I knew that I wasn't. I was watching Dudley Butterfield. So, you know, right through that teen pubescent period, I realised that there was something a little bit different. You know, I'd cut out ads from Bond's underwear or something like that. So.
Did you have any understanding of the word gay or that it meant that you were attracted to men, or was it just something that you sort of let slide and, you know, this is happening, I'm not sure why?
Well, it was starting to be openly talked about with a program like Number 96 on the screen and the program called The Box afterwards, and there were identifiable gay characters in those TV series. Now, up until then, and, you know, it was 70s was the sexual revolution time, those sorts of things weren't talked about. You know, maybe there'd be a single uncle or a single somebody or other, and those things weren't talked about. They were just, oh, yeah, bachelors. So,
but I guess in the 70s they were presented as quite stereotypical. Like
of course.
The gay characters in both The Box and Number 96 were so out there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've spoken to other people that also watched those shows and they said, well, I didn't want to be gay because I didn't want to be like those characters.
I think I wanted to be like those characters.
Because they weren't really tragic, were they? They were just
part of a small community. So it was a portrayal of a larger community, I suppose. It was set in Paddington in Sydney, in case people haven't heard of the program. So it was a block of apartments and different styles of people lived in different areas.
It was like Friends, except in the 70s, with a very different, you know, very Australian aspect to it. My parents didn't let me watch it, but I used to creep in once they started watching it and creep in and sit at the breakfast bar and watch over the top of the breakfast bar. And if I could, I'd stay up for The Box as well. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
So, yeah, and then, you know, I began to explore and, you know, made friendships and learnt all sorts of things, I suppose.
Through school or a little bit older?
School and then certainly after school.
Do you remember the first person you met that felt the same as you or that you related to on that level in terms of a sexuality focus?
That's a hard one, I think. I remember my first boyfriend. His name was Tony the Animal. I called him the Animal, but he was an amazing guy, a few years older than I was, and this was in a period that I lived in Sydney. And, you know, I think I well and truly came out to myself in Sydney because one of the most important parts about our sexuality identification is where we actually come out to ourselves, and then we're actually able to take that step from there and come out to other people. And that was that period up there. And then I came out to my sister and my friends and my parents and went through that whole process.
How old were you when you went off to Sydney?
I was about 17, 18.
That's very young to move cities and...
Yeah, but like I was...
Off you went?
I was on fire. I don't know.
What led you to a move like that at such a young age?
I just wanted something different. I'd been working in this office and I could get a transfer up there and I just wanted to see the world. To me, Sydney was the world. You know, we grew up, America was the ideal. It's no longer the ideal, but to me, Sydney was another place. And
were you still living at home at that stage?
Yes, I was.
And how did your parents cope with you up and leaving to go to Sydney?
Probably a little bit disappointed about that, but they knew that I wanted to grow and that I wanted to do things, and they were supportive about that. This was before I'd come out, but that did surprise me at the time. But, you know, I got into life up there, late 70s, in Sydney, a young gay man. I had a ball.
So you went up there to work. Whereabouts were you living?
I was living in Redfern, tough area in those days.
Yeah,
it was fun. I shared houses with students and other people and, had a ball up there. It was really good fun. As I say, I met my first boyfriend and, that wasn't a long affair, but it was good fun and I continued meeting people and socialising and going out and doing all the things that young people do, even today.
So after you kind of established yourself as, I'm a gay man, I'm living in Sydney, was there a process where you came out to your family?
Well, yeah. Firstly, with my sister, she'd visited me in Sydney at one stage and I moved back down just before I turned 21 and I came out to her when I came back down here and then to my parents as well. That was back in 1981. So the friends that I had in Sydney I'd already come out to, of course, because I had a new life. I had a fresh life when I first arrived up there. Maybe in the back of my mind that's what I was trying to achieve, to be the person I really wanted to be. And that drive was there in order to do that, and that's why I moved to Sydney. Moving back to Melbourne was because Melbourne was just a much better place to be, even in those days.
Why do you say that?
I don't know. I think maybe just, it just felt more familiar. Sydney was great fun, but it was certainly more familiar in Melbourne. There was a lot more going on. I can't think back that far to the age of 21. But I landed on my feet and started working and having a good time down here. I transferred that down here, I suppose, in a way.
And how did it go coming out to your parents?
Because they were an older generation, it was a pretty short conversation. It was, okay, well, that's good. And what would you like for dinner? It was like that style of thing. They were probably thinking in their minds, what will the neighbours think? But you know what? We can just accept that and just dismiss that and continue on. It was that sort of style of thing. It wasn't sort of, oh, my goodness, what's going to happen to you or anything like that. What did we do wrong? They probably did blame themselves. I don't know. Many people did in those days. And it wasn't like the, we love you so much more even so because you're honest with us and everything else. It was just sort of almost a dismissal. It was like, okay, now what's next?
Would you say it was a sort of form of being tolerated?
Probably.
Yeah. Probably. Did they talk about it much from there? Like, did you take partners home or anything like that?
No, they didn't really want to. And I gauged from them that wasn't something they really wanted to know about. That was maybe a disappointment, but you know what? That's all there is to it. Let's not speak of this too much. These days there would certainly hopefully be more discussion or whether it's disagreement or whether it's agreement. You'd expect more, but...
So they didn't meet partners at all through their life?
Yeah. No, yeah. Exactly.
How did that make you feel? It's kind of like, your life's been erased.
No, look, it was sort of not quite a live and let live, but it was you get on with your life, we'll get on with our lives. And, by this stage they were getting closer to their retirement and they were quite happy to do what they did themselves and leave their two children to do what they do themselves.
Tell me about moving back to Melbourne.
Yeah.
Whereabouts did you live when you came back?
Well, I first moved in with my parents and I'd forgotten how much and how incessant the Bellbirds were in Blackburn. And I lived there for about 3 weeks and then moved into a small flat in South Yarra by myself. That was great fun because, it was the first time that I'd lived by myself and had to be reliant upon myself. That was an interesting period. And then I got to know about clubs and things. There was an explosion at that time in the 80s in Melbourne. And I participated in that lifestyle. It was great fun.
Tell me about 80s queer Melbourne.
No, there was a different place to go to on a different night of every night of the week. You could go to Inflation on a Tuesday. You could go to Mandate on a weekend. Or you could go to all different clubs and bars all around Melbourne. That's how you met men, strangely enough. And that's why I embraced it like you wouldn't believe.
Are you still someone who likes to go to gay venues?
I like to go to venues for a different thing. And I would consider venues more along the lines of theatre and cabaret and things like that. Whether they're gay or not, it doesn't really matter. But that's the sort of enjoyment I get now. I don't go to bars because I don't drink. I don't go to dance parties because, number one, I wasn't a great dancer. But also, number two, they're not holding anything for me. There's no attraction there that I find, I've got to get to the latest whatever it is. But then, you know, these days a lot of people isolate more so because it's about social media and it's about showing off what you've done, but that could be just a minuscule second. And we went out for hours and hours every weekend and every weeknight as well.
You're listening to Word for Word and I'm chatting to David Gale. Look, let's talk about addiction. What was your choice of substance?
Well, I did quite enjoy a drink, but, you know, that started even in earlier years. When I was doing later years of high school, binge drinking became part of the culture and I participated in that and I had a ball doing that. What we did was not very much, actually. We just drank and roamed the streets in a way. And there was a bit of a problem there that I think was identified by my parents, and they found some people who regularly had teenagers over to their house. You know, this, we're talking groups of 20 or 30 in Blackburn, and basically they were, in a way, providing a safe space for those that were doing that sort of thing. And, you know, we learnt to smoke dope a little bit, not necessarily there, but it was ending up in a safe space rather than putting ourselves at greater risk. So obviously my parents had had a discussion or knew of other people, and that was a way of harm minimalisation. So when I was by myself, I just continued on the tradition and I loved drinking and going out, because suddenly all of that apprehension or all of those problems that you might have in younger years or all of those issues with your own sexuality just disappeared. And the way to meet people was to go to bars and to clubs. And what would you do when you got to a bar or a club? You'd drink. Now, I didn't drink like other people, but I didn't know that at that time. I would drink to excess and continue doing that. And whether that was a continuation of what I'd learned in my formative years, in teen years, or not, I'm not sure.
Was there any addiction issues in your family that you know of?
No, no. I think my father would drink maybe a beer at Christmas or at a birthday, maybe a beer. And, you know, probably the first drink I ever had would have been a sip of a shandy, a sip. And I thought, well, that was just like a treat. But it certainly wasn't enough to have an effect.
So you probably can't remember the first time you had too much to drink, but I imagine you probably remember some of the times where you drank to excess and it made you feel how?
Drinking to excess made me feel invincible, and it certainly took away any need to worry about anything in life. It was pretty freeing, and it certainly took away any social awkwardness. It wasn't the magic panacea of everything about your life, but it certainly put everything else on hold for a while so that you didn't have to actually face yourself going, oh, look, you know, maybe I'm attracted to men, or maybe I should do better at this, or any little problem that was there would instantly dissolve.
I guess what I'm hearing is that drinking to the point where you kind of mask feelings, would you relate that to a sense of covering shame, like shame about your sexuality or who you are in the world? Is shame too strong a word?
Look, it could be in there in the mix, but it was probably just everything. You know, do we question why we hadn't taken this path instead of that path and therefore drink on it? But, you know, at the same time, people will drink on a bad thing and they'll also drink on a good thing. So there's nothing like drinking to excess because something bad has happened to mask those feelings. But there's also a good excuse to drink when you're celebrating over something. It's just how we actually drink.
Do you see the way you drank as different to other binge drinkers that did it socially, you know, occasionally, had a great time, got up the next day feeling a bit shabby and got on with their life, whereas for you it became an indispensable tool in your social repertoire?
Yeah, it did become a tool. And in the end, you are going to attract those other people that drink the same way that you do.
Is that because it gives you permission to keep doing it?
Yeah. If somebody is drinking much worse than you are, it sort of says to you, you know what, it's not as bad as they are. But, you know, you're going to keep on attracting those people and they're going to become your friends or, well, you know, friends I use as a loose word because it's all to do with enabling, if anything. And you have a common interest and that might be alcohol or your drug of choice.
What to you is the definition of addiction?
Well, I know that the opposite of addiction is connection. So to me, addiction means disconnection. It means isolation because it may not happen right away, but it is going to take you down that area. And, you know, I remember when I was thinking that I knew I had a huge drinking problem, that I was worried because I couldn't stop drinking in order to continue on, but I also was scared of stopping drinking as well. And when it gets to that sort of stage, you know that that's definitely addiction.
Were you someone who had to drink every day, or were you someone who sort of binge drank on weekends?
I drank every day.
You drank every day?
Every day. Maybe not in the mornings because the hangovers were so bad, but certainly by the end of the workday, I had permission to drink straight away. And I would keep on drinking right until it was time to go to sleep. But in fact, it was weird because it would be a coming to process in the morning and blacking out at the end of the day.
So it's sort of a constant roller coaster of getting yourself up, putting yourself to sleep, and repeating.
It's not even a roller coaster. It's actually a shrinking of your world. Your world becomes work, bottle shop, drink, sleep. And it becomes a very small world that you live in. It might look like a big world to you, but it keeps on shrinking and becoming smaller and smaller and smaller.
When did you realise that you did have a problem with your drinking?
Probably, I don't know, in my 30s I knew that I was drinking a lot. In my 40s I was probably coming to the realisation, early 40s, that I couldn't function without drinking. I didn't think that was unusual, though, and it wasn't that I was thinking, oh, you know, there might be a problem here. I lost my licence somewhere in my 30s or something. I regained it back later on, but I didn't think, well, hang on, I lost my licence. Maybe there's a drinking problem, or I may not have been able to do certain things, and I never thought, oh, is that because of the problem that I have? I never put the two and two together. And at one stage, you know, I was living in a beautiful apartment in the city that I'd bought, and I was continuing doing that and thinking, well, this is about as good as it gets. That's all there is to it. And I was satisfied, and I thought, okay. So I'd get up, go to work, pay the bills, come home, drink, go to sleep.
Would you call that sort of a high-functioning alcoholic?
Yeah. I was able to do those things, and a lot of people are. A lot of people can't as well. But it was what I could do. And it's sort of akin to juggling balls in the air, and you keep on juggling those balls until finally you drop one of them, two of them. Suddenly you drop them all, and then that's about it.
What do you mean by that? Like, in terms of dropping balls, would it be, say, something like you might lose a friend, that's one ball dropped?
Yeah.
You might lose your job.
Might lose a partner.
That's another one.
Might lose a house.
Yeah.
Might lose all your money. Might lose everything. But you keep on repelling people because, you know, even the people that love us the most will continue to move away from us because we're becoming unmanageable. And also our behaviour becomes particularly appalling. And also there's judgment, and there's all sorts of ways that we repel people without realising it because of the ego. And, you know, as an alcoholic, it's all about high ego and low self-esteem.
Did you have other people in your life that were concerned about you drinking?
One of my partners, well, my first major partner for 17 and three quarter years, I don't know why I hang on to that three quarters, but
it's important.
For that long, was an enabler, and we both drank like you wouldn't believe. We also took drugs as well, but the main addiction was certainly alcohol. That became very easy. It was really easy to do that together.
Did you have times in your life where you thought, I really need to make some changes here, but then you have a partner who's also there, you're sort of enabling each other, you're sort of almost egging each other on or giving yourselves permission to not do anything about it?
Well, I think there was a realisation that life wasn't going as it should, and probably the last 7 3/4 years of that life, I was certainly cheating because that seemed fair enough to do because nobody knew how bad my life was. And I continued to do that and then suddenly realised, well, you know what, this is not a dress rehearsal. And I decided to finish that relationship.
When you say cheating, you were outside the relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And truly. It was funny because I had a double standard, because if I'd ever caught him cheating, I would have gone, well, you know what, that's it, it's all over. But I gave myself permission to do that, and with impunity.
Did you have any friends that sort of approached you and said, hey, David, you seem to have a bit of an issue here with drinking? Did you have anyone in your life like that?
I think somewhere along the line there would have been a couple of people that had mentioned that you don't drink like everybody else, and that would have been to the two of us as couples, because wherever we went, we took booze, and wherever we left, we went to booze or took booze with us as well. But it was more like, well, you know what? If somebody called me an alcoholic, I could be proud of that. I could be a martyr.
Why is that?
I'm an alcoholic. I don't know. Maybe it harkens back to people like Judy Garland or other people that have had big issues. We have gay icons in our history that, you know, had torturous lives. Why are we even attracted to those sorts of people? I don't know.
Do you think in your travels over the past, say, 30 years, do you think that addiction, particularly, well, let's just stick to your addiction, alcohol abuse is fairly rife in the LGBTIQ+ community?
The addiction rates within our community are certainly higher than in the general population. So do we put it down to our coming out stories, our not coming out stories? Should we put it down to, you know, the experiences that we've had that you mentioned shame before? Many people may feel ashamed of their sexuality and want to normalise themselves. Or, you know, there are certain reasons that can be explored as far as where our addiction stems from. But certainly within our community, the statistics prove over and over again that we do have higher rates of addiction of drugs and alcohol.
Are there many services geared straight towards that community here in Melbourne?
I've found out that there are an awful lot. But of course, you've got to seek help. Nobody is going to kick an addiction unless they actually take that first step. And it's got to be for themselves as well. There are an awful lot of services. From a first step could even just be being honest with your doctor and saying, yes, I do drink two drinks a day. It's not two drinks, it's actually two bottles. And, you know, your GP might say, well, how about a psychiatric plan or a psychology plan? And here's your 10 free visits to go and see a psychologist and actually discuss that further.
Talk me through the turning point in your life. I mean, obviously that's come because you've been 13 years in recovery after 30 years of addiction, would you say?
Yeah.
Yeah. That is a substantial part of your adult life.
Yeah.
What on earth was the turning point that brought you to making some significant changes?
Alone. Alone was the moment, I think. And I'd finally achieved that way to drink the way that I had always wanted to drink, to excess, all the time, 24/7.
So you had a relationship breakup.
Yeah. So during that time, I said to that partner, look, you know, I think we need to take a little bit of a break. So I had a little bit of free time. There was another alcoholic I knew at that time, and we sort of holed up and drank quite a lot. I was living in the CBD still, but a little further over at QV, which incidentally was where I was born, the Queen Victoria Hospital. I'd bought an apartment where I'd come out of the womb, weirdly enough. But so, you know, you sit on the 12th floor in an apartment. You're away from everything else. You're just living in the sky. You can go downstairs, engage with the world, and then come back and go back up to your box. And then I basically went into a bit of a meltdown, and I closed off everything. Wouldn't take calls, wouldn't answer the intercom. You're in the perfect place to be able to do that. My partner started getting a little bit concerned about me. I just rejected all of that. My boss was getting concerned about me, rejected all of that, stayed up there in that little box, went out and got alcohol whenever I needed it, and drank myself stupid for about 2 weeks. And then somewhere this little voice in my head said, I don't want to be an alcoholic. Don't know where the voice came from.
Yeah, I find that fascinating because, you know, where does that voice come from?
Is it a divine intervention? I don't know.
What in you, David, had that little voice at that stage of our life say, you know what, we're done with this, let's move on, make some changes?
It was just that moment, and I don't know where it came from, and I decided, okay, well, it's time to do something. And I woke up the next morning and went for a run, not a very big run, but a little run, and enjoyed that, and suddenly thought, you know what, this is the start. This is the start. I've got to do something about this.
Was that the first time you'd been running?
No, I had been running a little bit during my alcoholic drinking period. That's even good. In those later years, I don't know how I did every children's hospital run somehow. I always set those little goals, you know, high functioning alcoholic, I've got to have a goal, and that's what I'm going to do, sort of thing.
Every
I'm
goal so except determined. The one you should have had.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I talked more about that before, about how, you know, I knew there was something wrong, but I just couldn't figure it out. So I just accepted this is what my lot is in life. But yeah, I went out for a run, and then I found other people that were like me.
How did you go about doing that?
I entered a 12-step program, and suddenly I heard people talk the same language that I was thinking.
So did you get on Google or something and just Google alcohol, Melbourne?
Yeah.
You know, what was the very first step you took?
I made a phone call and found out that I could connect with people and took it from there.
So you started going to meetings, 12-step, working the 12 steps.
Heard people that had the same story, identified straight away. That was quite an eye-opener. And also finding out that it was a program of abstinence, I thought, how am I going to do this? I have no idea how this will happen. But it seemed to work. I suddenly felt better every day. Every day was an improvement, whether I did anything or not. I still felt better. And I found, you know, I was 46 and I'm suddenly going, there must be something in this.
How long did it take for you to feel better?
Well, for a good 10 years, I'd been waking up with a hangover every day. So straight away, I felt better. I started eating sugar. Sugar was fantastic because that's basically an alcohol replacement. But, you know, I'd go and exercise each day and suddenly thought, well, you know what? I feel better. I look better. I'm able to function better. And I could actually set small goals and actually achieve those sorts of things.
Did you have any periods of relapse where you just kind of went, oh, it's all very hard and I'm going to have another drink?
I'm one of the fortunate people that just got it straight away. Somehow, I don't know why, but I was really lucky and just realised, you know what? Once again, just like with the first boyfriend, it's not a dress rehearsal. It's time to get on with it. I wish I'd learnt, you know, many years before, but, you know, that just wasn't my story.
It's kind of a high level of being wise to be an addict, be dependent on something to medicate your feelings or help you go out socially, to kind of suddenly wake up and go, you know what? I'm going to make this change and then find something that works. That seems unusual to me that you would find something.
It is a complete 180-degree turnaround. So, you know, it is completely different. It's like doing something different every day of your life because you're not programmed to do that. My default position is to drink until I'm dead. But suddenly it changes and there's a shift. And, you know, once you realise that you're not the only one as well, because nobody knows how hard my life is while I'm drinking, you wouldn't understand, suddenly it becomes, oh, hang on, there's heaps of other people like me. And then you meet people that are successful and that are doing well and you suddenly go, well, I want a bit of that. That would be really nice too. And you learn all sorts of different ways of engaging in life. You also learn to be honest. You have to be honest. And maybe that voice was me finally being honest with myself and going, I don't want to be an alcoholic. I've got to do something about this. First time I was actually being honest. Because I was a liar. I was a cheat. I would manipulate. I would find every way possible to take advantage. I was a people pleaser. I did all sorts of things in order to ultimately get another drink.
It's a massive change in personality too. And it takes me back to the word connection.
Mm-hmm.
So once you started on this 12-step journey, you met other people in similar, with similar addictions, probably with very different lives.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of sense among some people that alcoholics are homeless on the street.
Once you realise that you could be the Prime Minister of this country or you could be a homeless person on the street and still be affected in the same way, you realise it's to do with hearing similarities about your story rather than differences. If I keep on thinking to myself, well, oh, no, I wasn't that bad or, oh, no, I wasn't affected in that way, I'll have a completely closed mind. But once you start actually hearing similarities, we all have the same story in our particular program. So it's interesting to hear amazing stories from people and how they've turned their lives around. It's inspiring. But at the same time, the person that enters a program like this on the first day is probably the most important person because it reminds me where I actually was before that and how life was. It's to do with unmanageability and a lack of power, unable to control. So certainly my addiction, I certainly wasn't able to control that. And once you actually realise that you're completely powerless over alcohol, and once you realise that your life is that unmanageable and stop convincing yourself, oh, maybe it wasn't that bad, you can do a change, you can affect a change and hopefully become a better person out of that.
Because it strikes me that the word illusion is key too, because when you're in the midst of an addiction and you're high functioning, that you do have an illusion that, well, I can control this when I want to, but I just can't be bothered right now, or I've got something coming up that's going to be stressful, I won't do it now, I'll do it later. So I can control it, I just don't want to control it.
Control's a great default position. And, you know, 30 years of drinking has left me with all sorts of default ways of dealing with things that I want to go back to, but if I actually think about it, no, that's not the way to do it. So I don't know. It was a complete metamorphosis for me and, you know, I'm really proud of that and I'm happy about that and hopefully other people can find that way as well.
You're listening to Word for Word and I'm chatting to David Gale. How did you maintain it and how do you still maintain it? Do you think about alcohol now and have days where you really feel like a drink?
Don't even see it. And in fact, during the midsummer period, I was out a lot of shows and there's bars at every show and I don't even see those. I can see a big jug of water, but I can't actually see people drinking. You know, occasionally I'll see the glint of a glass on a summer's day where people are sitting around a large table and think, gee, that looks really good. Oh, I wish I was one of those. And that's the jealousy that I can't actually drink like those people. But it's not me wanting to actually have a drink. My partner drinks very, very, very seldom. But at the same time, I'd be there pouring the glass going, well, you know, why does he only sip on this? It's weird, but it doesn't feature in my life anymore. And that probably left me after about 8 or 9 months of sobriety, where I suddenly realised that I can do anything I want to do, and hopefully will be able to do, because I've lost that bondage of alcohol and its effect on my life, because the desire does actually leave you.
Because I have spoken to some people in here that even 20, 30 years on still see people drinking and find it
slowly. They're drinking slowly.
Well, they find it difficult to see and not feel a bit of envy or, well, perhaps I could just have one. And they remove themselves from alcohol so much they wouldn't actually be pouring a glass for someone else.
The first thought rather than the first action. And as long as the first action and the first thought are different, you should be okay. That's the sort of advice that I have.
I mean, it seems like you had a massive metamorphosis. Did you at any stage, you know, really sort of want to drink and have a technique for not going down to the bottle shop and buying something?
I think I'd got to the stage where if I did go back out and relapse, I wouldn't be able to find my way back. And that was a fear, a healthy fear, that if I went back out and did that and went to bars and started drinking again, it would be the same, if not worse. And, you know, personal stories that I've heard from people that have been down that path say that it is worse, and it is, it just continues to progress. It's a progressive disease, just as recovery is also progressive as well. I don't think I would have been able to find my way back, and that was a healthy fear to have at that time. And I've heard stories where, you know, people have gone back out after many, many years, and it can take longer and longer to be able to find the way back to where they've gone.
Do you still attend 12-step meetings?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. On a regular basis or just whenever you need to?
On a regular basis, and also in order to help other people as well. You know, it's important that we hopefully pass the message to other people and also be reminded of what it was like before. I can easily forget what it was like. I can sort of go, you know, it wasn't that bad.
Let's talk a little bit about Australia's drinking culture.
Mm.
It appears to be a bit of a problem. I heard some statistics recently that we drink 25% of the world's alcohol or, you know, something.
Whatever it is.
It was something like that. I'm not peer reviewing here. You know, it was quite extraordinary in terms of other cultures. What do you see in terms of, say, marketing of alcohol and the way it's presented in public and the way we talk about it?
There's mixed messages. You know, we might hear one day that one standard drink a day is a safe level. We might go, oh no, but like 6 months ago it was 2 standard drinks a day. So, you know, really I can have 2. And if I've got a large glass, I can just fill that up. That counts as 1, even though it's probably 3 or 4 or something like that. We also hear messages about what are acceptable levels, that there's antioxidants that make things good, just like with chocolate or other things. And it's justification as well. The drinking culture is pretty ingrained, but at the same time, alcohol consumption rates in this country are going down. I was talking to some people from the Anti-Cancer Council, and they were talking about how a target group of people with a campaign that they were doing at that time was about how women are drinking more and more later in their life, maybe in their 50s and their 60s, and that alcohol actually causes cancer. Now, it's a legal drug, so people have got access to it. And, you know, if people try and question occasionally what their consumption levels are like or the reasons behind it, hopefully they might actually see that there is a problem. You know, we have things like, is it dry February or January? I can't remember which month.
Feb fast. Dry July.
Where somebody might go, okay, well, I'll do dry July and Feb fast. And if I do drink, well, I can put some money into a charity. So that justifies it. But at the same time, they're not necessarily always questioning. A great journalist, Jill Stark, was with The Age many years ago, and she started writing about her experiences of not drinking for a year. She wasn't an alcoholic, but she was surprised that there was so much ingrained drinking culture. And certainly being a journo in the days that she first started, it was journalistic pursuits all day long and then straight to the pub, and she started to question that she was drinking copious amounts of alcohol and found out that there was a different way, and then found out that about all sorts of different groups around Australia, and finally decided to re-engage. But she certainly didn't re-engage in the same way that she did before.
In your opinion, and obviously you're not a scientist, you're just someone who's had an incredible experience with addiction, what do you make of the sorts of programs that don't advocate abstinence, that try to minimise the drinking? Is that something that could have worked for you?
Yeah, I probably haven't had experience in those sorts of programs. But as I say, it's still to do with connection. Through the series that we've been doing on this radio station, we've found that the most successful ways that people do modify their behaviour is through peer group. You know, if you're on a helpline for people that are affected by those that are in addiction. So, you know, if you were a mother or father or a sibling or a partner and you needed some help because your partner is drinking so much, there's a helpline. It's called Shark Alcohol Drug and Helpline. And the people that man those phones are actually peer group. So they're people that have been through this similar sort of experience of addiction, and they're actually able to talk to the people that ring that phone group. It's a very obscure little group, but at the same time, any of the programs that we've seen that address addiction with people that have been through a similar experience are the ones that seem to be the most successful.
Talk me through some of the things that you have done in your life in the past 13 years that you would never have done as an addict.
I started travelling. I started running. I certainly did marathons. The addict in me just said I have to do more and I have to please more people and do better, but not necessarily to the addiction level, but certainly to an area where I could feel proud of myself in my own achievements, which came from myself. It's funny because I pursued a number of sports, joined a shooting club for a while, and also I got a Victorian skydiving license. I started jumping out of planes for sheer fun. But the sports and the pursuits that I've done, I've realised all are to do with self, and it's to do with trust, or it's to do with motivation, or it's to do with safety, or, you know, you go for a run and you let your mind just to settle, and it's an internal process that comes out of that. When it comes to do with something like shooting, it's all to do with stillness and safety, and it's reflective back upon yourself. The same with skydiving. It's not about exhilaration, and it's not about adrenaline. It's about a certain amount of discipline. So I've been sort of attracted to those sorts of things.
And you've also entered into radio as well in the last few years, and you host a show on Joy 94.9 called Hooked,
which is
about addiction.
Yeah.
What led you to want to sort of talk publicly about it? You know, it's kind of a brave thing to put yourself out there and say, look, I was an addict for 30 years, now I'm in recovery. A lot of people want to be private about that sort of thing. What led you to actually creating a show about it?
Well, a great mate of mine, Russ Masterton, hosts the program with me, so we're co-hosts. And we were talking, we're both in recovery, and we were talking about addiction in the LGBTI community and it being higher, and felt, well, you know, once you're in radio, you suddenly realise that you actually have a voice. It's not necessarily a responsibility, but it's certainly one way of being able to communicate to people, and why not use that voice? And we had that discussion and found that nobody else was really having that conversation within our community. I would argue that nobody's having that conversation in the wider community. We were just talking about drinking culture before, and there are those mixed messages. But, you know, there is all different forms of addiction, and we've covered so many different ones on our program, which has been a privilege to do. But until we actually start talking about it, in the end, if one person decided or questioned themselves and actually went and thought, look, I need to make a first step, and did something out of that, as far as we're concerned, our brief is complete. But at the same time, it's been a great journey to find that there are so many people working within that space in our LGBTI community. There are so many free services. There are people that are just in the professional world that deal with addiction, and certainly with the LGBTI community, on a daily basis. And there's also people in recovery that have their stories to tell as well. It's become quite a passion. It's also a manifestation of helping other people as well, which, you know, over 13 years ago, I didn't want to help anybody except for myself, but it's quite a journey to get there, and a journey in radio that ended us up at the Community Broadcasting of Australia Awards last year. Our program was nominated, and we didn't win the prize of excellence in journalism, but what a ride to actually get to that
place. Yeah, it's amazing to be nominated. Take me back to some of the relationships that would have changed when you changed your relationship to alcohol. Did you lose friendships over your difference in dealing with alcohol? Did your social world change?
Friendships seems to be, you know, the people that I saw up until that point, I would have considered friends, but they probably weren't friends. They were just other people that were addicted to alcohol and other drugs. So I started afresh. There were certainly a few people that were around me that had stuck through, waiting for me to hopefully complete that journey, as I did. But otherwise, I really started fresh. And, you know, it's interesting because you start off in a new life of honesty, and you have to try and stop trying to please people, and you have to try and stop trying to manipulate. And when you sort of come out as a fresh person, it's like a reset button where you can start all over again.
Did you have difficult conversations with friends where you just kind of said, look, I actually can't have this friendship anymore because I'm not an addict, and you perhaps are?
Probably just had to leave those people by the wayside. And if I did see them, I had to start setting boundaries. And certainly with the ex-partner from all those years back, I had to set a boundary because we were seeing each other in a daily life close to my workplace. And I had to set a very strict boundary when things started to get a little bit out of control. We'd sort of maintained a friendship through the split up and then through my next relationship, but then it just got not very good at all. But I always made sure that he knew that I would be available if need be, and that I'd be there.
Tell me about your relationship. So you had the 17-year, yep. And then I think you had seven...
A 6-year relationship, yep. And that was sort of 3 years on either side of finding out, you know, that I could lead a sober life. So that relationship rekindled, and that continued on for a few more years. And then I suppose his role changed and my life changed, so... That sort of ended. And then I met the
what
man.
What do you mean his role changed?
Well, in the relationship of looking after everything and making sure everything turned out okay and being the protector or being the helper or the cleaner-upper or whatever.
It's really difficult, isn't it? Because it must have been, I imagine it might have been something that he really longed for you to find health, and then you did.
And then it wasn't right for him, perhaps.
Yeah, then
we change as well as people. So suddenly you're not seeing the person that you'd met all those years before.
Was that a mutual decision to...
Yeah, it was sort of a mutual decision. Yeah. And then about a year or so later, I met the man of my dreams, and we had a 5-year relationship. He also lived in the city as well. He was the one until he finally moved to Queensland to take care of his parents. That's the sort of guy he was. Maybe it was also the family that he came from, but he had that relationship that I probably never had, and I had to respect that decision because my life is quite firmly here in Melbourne.
It's a very mature way of looking at things. I don't think a lesbian would do that. They'd probably just head
hire
off
the U-Haul.
They'd hire the U-Haul and head off to Queensland. That's what most of us would do, I think.
Yeah, but
are you
think,
still in touch with him?
Yeah, a little bit still. But I think I'd matured that much in sobriety that I could see what would be right for me. And the connection I have with people here in Melbourne is just so great that I didn't want to forego that. Sure, we can start again, and I'm not scared of that sort of thing. But at the same time, I just felt that the relationships I had here already were important in my life and perhaps also in my sobriety as well.
Tell me about your current relationship.
I'm enjoying a relationship of just on a year now.
Still in honeymoon
and if
phase.
He's, if he's listening, he's probably thinking, well, yeah, I know I'm not the one. No, we've had talks about that as well. But certainly a younger man and a very different guy who I love quite dearly. And we have our differences, as everybody does, in relationships. And fortunately, in sobriety, I've learnt tools to be able to negotiate a relationship. It's probably one of the hardest things we're going to do in our life is a relationship. Probably. No, it is. It is. There's lots of hard things we'll do in life, but, you know, they're rewarding. I sometimes wake up in the morning and think, what are you doing here? I'm just really blessed to have an amazing man to share this period of my life. In fact, you know, I've had 4 major relationships. This is the 4th one. And what a privilege is that? You know, some people go through their lives lonely. But yeah, I've been really blessed.
Talk me through the future, David. What's ahead for you?
Who knows? I know what's going to happen today, and that's about it. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You know, I have plans, but at the same time, if they don't come to fruition, it's not the be-all and end-all. It's not something I'm going to drink on, for sure, and that's possibly how life would have been. How on earth could this happen to me, and why didn't this go the way that I planned it to? I'm sort of looking at trying to make some of the things that I really enjoy in life a little bit more important. I'm refocusing. Before the program, I was just talking to you about how at the start of this decade, it was suggested that you look at your previous 10 years. I identified the things that I really enjoy, and I could see that, you know, we prioritize the things that we have to do above those things, and the things that we enjoy sort of take second place. I'm trying to readdress that balance, and you know, who knows where that's going to lead me. I've been cooking and baking, and that's something I get enjoyment out of because it's meditation. I was out running this morning because that's something I enjoy. That's meditation as well. Last night I was reading, strangely enough, I was reading Corey White's book called The Prettiest Horse in the Glue Factory, and it's about his life of growing up. Corey White's an Australian comedian, and he also suffered from addiction. I don't just exclusively read addiction, but it's funny because I was just reading in peace, and I really enjoyed that. I had some jazz playing at the same time. It was just sensational. But they're the things, little examples of things that we really enjoy. Normally they take second place and you go, oh no, I'm too busy for all of that. And it's great to be able to re-engage. So I don't know where this life's going to take me. It's not a short life. You know, when people say life's short, it's actually a long life and we've got to enjoy it every day. One thing that I've noticed coming out of addiction is that I want to squeeze the most out of life. I just adore it. Absolutely adore living and getting on with things. You know, I'll travel again this year and see where that takes me and enjoy those experiences and hopefully go to cultures and learn things that I've never learned before. It's an amazing life and it is going to be long. I was living a different version of long life where I was slowly dying and I was drinking every day. Nothing happened to me like being hit by a train. But if I remained in addiction, I would either end up in jail, in a psych ward, or dead. And I chose the other.
Well, it's an incredible journey, and I just want to thank you, David, for sharing that with me. I think we can agree that the general theme of today has been connection, and both your lack of connection with your previous self and the fact that you are now, you know, utterly connected with yourself and those around you and the things that you're embracing in your life. And just want to thank you for coming in and sharing. And I hope, you know, as you say before, it, you know, if one person can get some inspiration out of this, then we've done a good job. Thanks.
Radio is a passion. It's great to be here.
Thanks, David.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Lisa Daniel, with production and editorial support by Tom Morgan from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 stations across the community radio network and is available for download at joy.org.au and anywhere you get your podcasts.
You should. looking for your